Welcome on to the Dunked On Basketball Podcast, live post-game from Oracle Arena. I guess it won't be live by the time you guys hear it, but it was a 98-78 victory for the Warriors as they've restored order in this series in a big way. Daniel, you're here tonight with me watching the game. What are your thoughts on this?
I thought that the Warriors got notable contributions from a lot of different guys in their roster. I mean, people talk about this being Steph Curry and Klay Thompson's team, but I thought Harrison Barnes in particular played really well. Draymond had some shots. And Iguodala and Livingston defensively, I thought, played a major role in their success. As you know, the Grizzlies only scored 78 points in this game. That this was a defensive win more than an offensive win, despite Curry's explosion at the end of the first quarter.
Yeah, the Warriors really weren't that much more above a point per possession in this game, but yeah, it was a fantastic defensive effort. It was the big reason why I thought Memphis was not going to stand a chance in the series to start with, that they just weren't going to be able to score. There was some hope that with Tony Allen out, they might be able to score a little better. In fact, they had probably their worst scoring game of the series. And now, you know, there's not a lot of tricks left in Dave Yeager's bag other than just hoping that home court and Tony Allen coming back can maybe help Memphis scratch a little more in the effort categories. That was one thing that I actually asked him about after he said he had missed Tony Allen in those areas. He said that, yeah, that was one of the big emphasis they had, was getting the loose balls, especially on long rebounds, and getting their 1-2s and 3s to rebound in addition to the two big guys. And they really struggled with that. They actually rebounded had a lower offensive rebound percentage than the Warriors did. And so if Memphis isn't dominating in that area, they're really not going to be able to keep up with Golden State.
And Golden State's a particularly dangerous team with 50-50 balls because they have so much offensive firepower. So when you're giving up generally even rougher looks as a defensively that way, and so that allows
Yeager
them
said
to
that too,
yeah, he did.
Yeah.
So. And another dynamic for Memphis in this game was that they had no threats from three, and that was something Marc Gasol talked about after the game, was something Coach Yeager talked about. And the only Memphis Grizzly who attempted more than 2 3-pointers was Vince Carter, who went 1 for 6. And it's hard to make an opponent respect your shooting when you're not shooting and you're not making it.
Another thing that they really, really struggled at once again was finishing inside. And number one, their biggest problem was they just didn't get any shots at the rim at all. In fact, in the second half, up until garbage time started, when both teams took out their starters with a couple minutes to go, the Grizzlies attempted 4 shots in the restricted area, making 2. And then they were a further 3 of 12 from the paint outside the restricted area. Just no way to have an efficient offense like that. And then they weren't taking or really hitting any threes either. So if you're not getting shots at the rim and you're not getting any threes, and then you're not even making your shots in the paint, there's just no way. And the Warriors really finally have figured out how to help and rotate, and they're getting much better. Those deep duck in post-ups that the Grizzlies were getting without help in games 2 and 3 have been completely eliminated now.
And another dynamic in this game is that Memphis started out strong early. They ended up with a lead about 13 points. And a lot of that was fueled by generating clean looks, but they were deep twos, and those deep twos were going in. And later on in the game, I don't think they were getting looks that were as good, and they weren't falling.
Yeah, and even in that first quarter, they were hitting everything. The Warriors were getting fast breaks. I think that on their first 5 fast breaks, they scored a total of 0 points just due to turnovers or 2 Harrison Barnes missed free throws. So that started to change pretty quickly at the end of that first quarter. And from there on, the Warriors rolled. Their defense was just completely impregnable. One of the adjustments that Kerr has made that hasn't gotten a lot of play so far has been going with a more defensive-oriented lineup, putting in Sean Livingston at the backup shooting guard instead of Barbosa. That's been just as big as the much ballyhooed adjustment of putting Bogut on Tony Allen when he was in. And, you know, that didn't matter at all today. But having that extra pressure on the perimeter, being able to switch everything 1 through 4 when Livingston is running the point with the second unit, really Memphis had no chance to score with that second unit, especially because they were running out Nick Calathes and Kostas Koufos at the same time, which is just not going to work offensively.
and we've talked about it in previous games, but Klay Thompson on Mike Conley is another change that happened in mid-series. And defensively, he was phenomenal in this game. I mean, Conley in Game 2, that was the last time we were at Oracle. Conley was electrifying. He was, you know, not only the emotional leader of the team, but he was the offensive engine of the team. And then since that switch, Memphis's offense has never really recovered.
Yeah, Conley managed to be a little bit efficient tonight. He was 5 out of 10. Got to the line 3 times, so 13 points on 11 shooting possessions, 5 assists. But nothing that was killing him. We always thought he was going to regress with those floaters and mid-rangers that he killed the Warriors with in Game 2. But he really has just not been able to get free at all. You know, he still has these other injuries that he's dealing with aside from the facial fractures, which seem to have limited his explosiveness to some degree. He's getting tired out guarding Steph, which he's done largely a pretty good job with, especially off the ball, with his kind of holding him around the waist every time he tries to make a move off the ball, which hasn't been getting called at all. But really, yeah, if Conley is not going to be able to be effective and really draw the defensive attention and distribute, then you're left with just trying to enter the ball in the post. Golden State's ball pressure has been much better over these last two games to prevent easy entry passes. They've been fronting. They've had help on the backside. The double teams have been working really just nothing easy for Memphis. They were just working 20 seconds to get a long two on every possession, and that's how you end up with 78 points, even in a fast, high possession game like this one was.
Absolutely, and another thing that we should definitely talk about in this game is that how few free throws were attempted, especially early on. In the first half, I think there were 11 free throws attempted, and then it picked up a little bit, so the backups had some. But this game had very few fouls. It was kind of an exciting game in that sense that, you know, it wasn't bogged down with that. I'm guessing we'll see each team have double that in the other Western Conference semifinal tomorrow. And that, you know, I think that's something that Memphis needs in order to establish themselves, because it also helped short-circuit the Warriors' transition offense.
Only 20 free throws attempted in the entire game. I think also Memphis can kind of get tired. Playing in the half court obviously benefits them, and the free throws give them a rest. It lets prevents Golden State from getting out in transition. That's another thing, and you deserve credit for saying this after Game 3, that they really needed to push the ball more even on makes, and that's clearly been an emphasis. Both Livingston and Curry, and then or whoever else gets the rebound and is pushing it, the emphasis has been to bring it up as fast as possible, even if there isn't an initial advantage. And on a couple of occasions, there was one where Livingston just was basically 1-on-4 and was able to get past Conley and get fouled. There's other times where just pushing the ball up floor just creates a slight defensive overreaction, and then you can have an opening. Or you simply are just beginning to run your offense faster and you have more time. So that's been great. I think a lot of point guards around the league, John Wall, Derrick Rose, are two who could really learn from the idea of, we're just going to get the ball up court as fast as possible. You know, when you have those teams starting to run their offense so late in the shot clock, but Golden State has really pushed that, and that's another reason why they've been able to get some easy transition points against this Memphis team.
And that has also coincided with Coach Kerr and the rest of the staff emphasizing getting better looks, you know, good, better, best, that kind of idea. And when you have an extra 5 seconds on the shot clock, that gives you time, and when you have the resources that this team has, you can use that time to your advantage. And it was kind of interesting after the game. Marc Gasol talked about, you know, playing quick but not playing too fast, and I think that's something that the Warriors still play too fast at points. They still rush into things, and that was something Steph talked about after the game too. But they've gotten a lot better at combining playing quickly but not rushing into a decision and knowing that they can do better if you don't get something great.
Yeah, I think what Mark was trying to talk about was moving the ball side to side. Those duck-ins that they're able to get in games 2 and 3 are really important, and those are you're only going to get those either off of a pick and roll or some sort of movement to begin with, or some kind of an early action, because the Warriors, Marc Gasol used the term loading up several times, and that's exactly what the Warriors do. If you're trying to enter the ball, first of all, you've got a ton of ball pressure on the passer. Memphis does not have perimeter guys who are going to blow by you if you pressure them real hard. And then you've got the post up, either a half front or a full front with help behind it. You really have to move the ball from side to side, but you know, you kind of run out of time with that if you're Memphis, and it's a big reason with the new help rules that you can't beat teams on post-ups alone, and Memphis is really struggling to do that now.
Can you think of any adjustments that Jaeger has left to really tricks in the bag to try to get this offense going?
I was going to ask him that, and I decided not to because coaches really, it takes them, they have to look at the film before they're going to come up with that or answer something like that, and obviously he's not going to say what it is anyway. So really, the key for them, you know, they just got to get better production and more effort from the guys who are out there, I think. I mean, I think Calathes, probably not someone who should be playing at all. I think they could go away from Kostakoufos as well, or at least, at the very least, only one of those two guys. And but other than that, you know, I don't think there's a lot there. Vince Carter may not have much left. He's at least a guy who can get his three-point shot off. Maybe he can get hot. You know, and maybe they can just muck the game up and get more foul calls and try and get it back that way. But I wouldn't give them much chance here in a Game 7, even if they are able to pull out a Game 6 on Friday night.
Yeah, it's definitely fair. One guy that I think would be interesting for them to use a little bit is John Luehr. I've liked him. You know, he's not going to be the savior for this team, but you know, give him 5 minutes and see if he can do something. Especially if you can get him against the rarity, which will happen less with Spates out there, without Spates out, meaning out of the games, is if the Warriors go more traditional with David Lee at power forward, see if you can stretch him out a little bit.
Yeah, I don't think that they're going to do that, frankly. I mean, the bench units have all been either Draymond Green or Harrison Barnes at the four. Lee was able to be effective tonight. I thought he actually was pretty good tonight in contrast to Game 4. He didn't get taken advantage of in the post nearly as badly, even though he was playing almost exclusively. I think he did play exclusively at center tonight, but he played a lot with Livingston at the point guard. He had those guys around him were able to protect him with their activity and their ball pressure so that they weren't really able to post him up, and then there was a double when the other team actually did get the ball to the guy Lee was guarding in post position. So Lee was able to be effective offensively. His post-ups, he's pretty much abandoned the idea of going one-on-one in the post, and when they throw it into him, that's usually a way to get some action going off the ball, and Lee is a nice passer, and then he's able to roll to the rim off that action, and he got a couple of nice buckets that way. So he was able to be effective in this game, playing at center, where also his lack of shooting doesn't hurt the spacing.
Anything else you'd like to talk about in this game?
Well, I think we should credit the Warriors yoga instructor for Harrison Barnes.
Jesus.
Remaining on the floor after he slipped on a wet spot and did the split. So that was good. Do your yoga, young athletes. And Barnes, again, and Iguodala as well, but Barnes has just been on fire from three-point range. He really is maturing into a fantastic role player for this team. And it'll be interesting to see where his negotiations end up for a new contract over the offseason.
Yeah, and I asked the Warriors PR staff after the game to just make sure nothing was happening because they didn't make any announcement, and they said he was fine. So as somebody who saw that and cringed and then watched the video and cringed some more, I'm very impressed with that. But as you said, that's why you stretch. That's why you do yoga.
Well, let's get on to another nail-biter in the Eastern Conference now. Washington, Atlanta, two lead changes in the final 10 seconds of this game. And it was finally Al Horford who hit the game winner on the offensive glass. 82-81, Hawks defeat the Wizards. Really, this game, although the Hawks kind of started off playing pretty beautifully, it devolved into yet another slog. Washington's defense was tremendous in this game. The Hawks' defense wasn't for a little while, and then they managed to shut them down in the second or in the fourth quarter. So it was Al Horford was the big star of this game, not only with the winning shot, but he had 23 points on 19 shooting possessions, which was amazing efficiency for this game. Hit a three, six offensive rebounds, five blocks. His activity was unbelievable. That five blocks even understates what he was able to do defensively. He was just pre-rotating every time it seemed like the Wizards had some advantage. He was fantastic in this game.
Yeah, he was huge. I mean, I think he was the reason they won, is pretty fair to say. And it was the other story for me with this game was the kind of duality of Dennis Schroeder. In the first half, from what I could tell, he was a big kind of... It wasn't necessarily his fault, quote-unquote, but it was him coming into the game replacing Jeff Teague that kind of turned what had been a good Atlanta first half into something less good. And then he ended up closing the game for them. There was reporting out there that Jeff Teague was the one who decided to have Schroeder stay in. And while he didn't make the final shot, it was kind of amazing to me that with the team down one on the last possession of the game, he was somebody who had the onions, let's say, to take that shot even though it didn't go in.
Yeah, John Wall got Schroeder a couple of times in that fourth quarter, the best shot-blocking point guard of all time, and I keep calling him that if he keeps coming up with blocks like this. And he got Schroeder on that final shot, too. Great block by him. But while it was an heroic effort from him, certainly, and his left hand actually looked great. He had a nice inside-out dribble lefty, finished with the left in transition early on that kind of made you think he was all right, but he still fell on that wrist a couple of times. He was able to gut it out. It was a really impressive performance in that sense. But, you know, he also had 6 turnovers, which was not ideal. 7 assists. You know, certainly was a great engine for Washington in this game, and in a slog game like this, you're not going to necessarily be that efficient. But also the Wizards role players were not able to get it going in this game. Pierce finally regressed to 3 of 9 from the field, although he did hit 3 of his 6 threes, including that big one at the end to put him up. Otto Porter, a pretty miserable 3 out of 13. Only 2 of those were three-pointers. Drew Gooden 0 for 4. Ramon Sessions 0 for 4. Nene was 4 of 11. So really, they did not get that three-point shooting. 4 out of 17 from the three-point line. Atlanta was really trying to stay home on the weak side much better than they had been before, and that was really effective in shutting down a Washington offense that had actually done better than you might have expected based on their regular season results.
Yeah, what did you think about how the Hawks defended Bradley Beal in this game?
Well, that was, I think, the main reason that Schroeder was out there down the stretch. Schroeder had been pretty bad. He then had a nice stretch with the starters to kind of start getting them back into it. And then I was wondering, you know, where is Jeff Teague and why isn't he in? But the reason for it, I think, was more defensive than offense because they switched up and put Carroll on John Wall. He was very effective doing that, both on the ball and then also because Wall isn't much of a shooter. Carroll, an excellent help defender and closeout guy when he's right, and so he was able to help out on actions in the paint and then get back to Wall once he gave the ball up. That worked really well, but then Teague, probably not someone who can really chase around Beal as well off a screen. Schroeder, a little more equipped to do that since he's a real high-effort guy, extremely quick. So that worked pretty well. Beal was stopped pretty well down the stretch, and the overall defense for Atlanta in the fourth quarter was outstanding up until the very end, and that's how they were able to get back into it because they were really down by 10 points early on in that fourth quarter.
Yeah, I thought because we were watching it at a work hole, and I had the feeling that, you know, the Hawks had the firepower to come back, but that it was one of those, the Wizards are playing pretty well, and it wasn't really offense to me that brought them back, it was defense. And some nights you need that, even if you're a team that has the rep of being an offensive team. I mean, that's why you see teams that are in the top 10 on both ends end up being successful, because they feed together and they lead to successful play.
So we should talk about the end of this game, too, with the 2 lead changes at the end. Hawks are up to yet another hashtag playoff Whitman awesome after timeout play. This time it was a nice hammer play where they disguised it extremely well with a Bradley Beal drive, and they set the hammer screen. For those who haven't listened to the previous podcast, that's just basically a back screen on the weak side for a shooter going into the corner, in this case Paul Pierce, wide open. Paul Millsap got totally caught, and Pierce was wide open and famously said to the Atlanta bench, series, after hitting that shot to build on his game from game 4. But it was not, in fact, series, because the Hawks came back, not really any kind of genius play, but they did do some nice things that you need to do in the late game. One was, especially when you're down, they went, they were down one, so they went early. It was a Schroeder pick and roll with Paul Millsap, with Pierce guarding Millsap. If I were Whitman, I might have gone back to two bigs, especially when you consider that they're going to be crashing. But that was the unit he'd had closing. Pierce, maybe not their best defensive player at this point, especially trying to guard a big. But, you know, I don't think that's any particularly egregious decision, you know, because if Paul Millsap hits a three, then it's, you know, why weren't you guarding him with a smaller guy? Granted, Millsap hasn't hit any threes in this series, but, you know, not an egregious error there. I think also I probably would have gone back to Teague if I were Coach Bud, because he's a better offensive player than Schroeder is. Has better passing vision, but Schroeder was the one who took it. Wall was a lot of penetration, but was there the whole time and just skied, blocked the shot. Great block by him, and caromed off the backboard. Nene was, he had to get in front and box out Millsap, because the beauty of the pick and roll is the roll man can go right to the basket, and if, you know, the guy guarding him has to help out at all, which even though Schroeder rejected the screen, Pierce was out of position to get a box out on Millsap. So Nene, who was guarding Al Horford, crashed in the lane. Horford was actually kind of out by the three-point line, you know, more in the mid-range area when the drive occurred. Nene had to get in. He got his box out on Millsap, actually, you know, so hard that he knocked him down and was in position for the rebound. But Horford got a running start, took off, and was able to just wrest it away from Nene. Great play by him. Great job by the Hawks to crash the offensive glass in a last shot situation where there's obviously no concern about transition defense. And that's another reason maybe Washington might have wanted to have some more rebounders in there. But just an awesome individual offensive play by Horford. He landed, may have potentially traveled. I think that when you have such a big effort like that and you come down, the refs will have a little more leniency. Then he was able to put it back up. Nene kind of got knocked out of the way, but, you know, that's just two men going for the rebound right there. If you go for the rebound and you get two hands on it the way Al Horford did, you're probably not going to get called for the foul. Usually it's using your hand, your offhand, that's going to get you called for the foul. So if you go up strong, hard, with two hands to get the ball, and you make contact, usually the refs aren't going to call it. They didn't hear. I think that was a correct no call. And Horford was able to drain it. And get a sorely needed 3-2 lead for Atlanta.
Yeah, and as you said, you know, what Al did on that play was exactly what you want somebody who's not involved in the play to do. You know, he knew that the worst case scenario for them was a missed shot, and that you can rectify that situation through an offensive rebound, and he did that. And I was a little bit surprised. I haven't seen many replays of it. That, you know, to me, when you're in that kind of situation, if you're Washington, you want as many guys in there as possible, because if you're going to clog it, you clog it. I mean, it doesn't really matter. It's not like you're going to put yourself in harm's way. And I'm not saying that caused what happened, not at all, but it did. It was something that at the time I kind of thought about a little bit.
Another guy we got to give some credit to is Mike Muscala, who had really an excellent stretch in the late first, early second quarter. He was, as long as he's not getting posted up, he could be pretty effective shooting the ball as a scorer. He had some nice finishes at the rim. Even protected the basket reasonably well on some drives, but then once they got Nene back in the game, then that kind of messed things up, and they had to have Millsap guard him. They went with the small lineup. Muscala had to guard either Pierce or Porter. He doesn't have the quickness to get out to the three-point line either, so as long as there's no post player in the game for the other team or another big that he can guard, he's okay. So you got to watch, really protect him in his matchups. But he's been someone who's been able to give them a little bit of offense with the second unit that was sorely lacking going into these last couple of games.
Yeah, I've definitely been a big fan of his contribution. And as you said, you want to limit his role, but it's a nice kind of a way of thinking about, you know, role players and things like that, that if you put him in the right situation, you can get 10 minutes out of them. And that's incredibly valuable when you think about how important each second can be in a playoff game. Look at this one. Now it's swung twice in 10 seconds.
Well, one of the things that's really important, especially in playoff coaching, is understanding why someone is able to be successful. And you know, maybe if you have a bench guy who plays really well in 4 or 5 minutes, a lot of times coaches will, and this is just kind of the psychology of coaching, you want to reward someone who's playing well, you don't want to take them out. But if the matchup changes and you know that just based on their skill set, they're not going to be able to be successful anymore, then maybe you need to take that guy out. Know that the reason he played well was because you put him in a situation to succeed, and now if he's no longer in that situation, you got to get somebody else in there.
Yep, definitely agreed. Anything else in this game, or do you want to move on to questions?
Well, it's not really on this game, but it's just generally an observation that I think some low-hanging coaching fruit would be to really encourage guys who take corner threes to get back on defense earlier, because usually you'll see that guys don't even start moving until they see whether their shot went in or not. And especially if your rebound comes off away from the basket, that's going to be too late for you to get back. And so especially if you're, you know, a point guard or a guard, you're going to be in trouble. And so you don't want someone to not finish their shot. But once you've landed from your shot, you've landed. It's over. You can start going back. And I think that's something that very easily could be drilled into guys, and you know, you might avoid giving up a couple buckets per game on that. Again, you don't want to mess with guys' shots, but if it's over, it's over. I mean, you don't have to just stand there and wait for it to go in, even though that's something that pretty much everyone does when they shoot a shot from the corner.
It's a great point. I'm happy you made it. I am. I mean, I think that it's obviously we're not in the position to change a lot of these things, but I do think that when you watch basketball, even at the highest levels, that there are things that you wired in at that point, but that can still be improved, and we see that in teams all the time.
Yeah, and it's always a balance for coaches, too, because there's only so many things you can harp on, and that's something that maybe you can just sort of build a habit over a year, over a course of a couple of years, but you know, you can only yell at guys for so much. You can only give them so many things mentally, especially certain players, to work on certain keys to that you need them to execute, and you know, obviously executing the scheme on a regular basis is more important than something like that. But on the other hand, it is something that's kind of low-hanging fruit, and maybe it's something that coaches can start to implement a little bit. All right, let's get into the questions. We'll start with Drew Carter, Drew DLE25. If anyone has a chance to guard Blake, it's Draymond, right?
Well, Andrew Bogut has had some success on him in previous series and in the past, just because the Clippers and Warriors play a lot. But Draymond can do a relatively good job on Blake as well. I think that the Warriors are a team that can do that, and they also have the benefit that DeAndre Jordan, while you have to respect him and he has this kind of special gravity, I don't think you need to defend him necessarily, you know, with your biggest guy, as long as he doesn't, you know, tower over that guy.
I think actually Draymond should be on Blake, both because Blake is going to be setting so many pick and rolls, that, and Paul now has matured into such a great shooter that you really don't want Bogut all the way out at the three-point line having to get out on Paul. Green is someone who can switch on to Paul late clock very easily, especially if you're guarding Klay Thompson guarding Paul with Klay Thompson, then you can switch with Green and Thompson, and Thompson can battle Blake Griffin pretty well, especially with some of the help guys that the Warriors can bring to bear from the weak side. So, and I think Green has done very well on Blake in the post also. Foul trouble also always an issue, but I thought he was by far the best defender on him in that series last year. And with Blake also having a better jump shot now, I don't know that I like Bogut on him so much, unless he just really starts killing it in the post. But Bogut, to me, is much better as a help guy than a one-on-one defender, and should be used in that role as much as possible, rather than taken away from the basket when there's a guy who can shoot. Blake has been punishing teams for leaving him wide open on those jumpers, and especially with how he's improved his J this year, I'm not sure that Bogut is the ideal matchup. So I think Draymond, really, among guys in the league, both in terms of his quickness and his strength, Blake is not a guy who has really long arms who's going to shoot over Draymond. He's got to kind of power in or get by you to get his shot off, rather than just kind of turning around and shooting. And with that the case, I think Draymond is a great matchup on him, as long as he doesn't get into foul trouble, which he's had some trouble with in this series.
Another question we got is from Drew Davis. How, Drew, you do? And the question is, who is the most likely to force and force a game seven and win a series, and who do you think is the least likely?
Houston, least likely. They're on the road. They've looked the worst probably of any of these teams. So they did have a blowout win. You might say Memphis also has looked the worst because they've now gotten blown out in all three Golden State wins in this series. And just there's probably the greatest differential in team quality in the regular season between Golden State and Memphis. And especially just as they've gotten blown out the last two games, both on their floor and on the Warriors' floor. So, and then there's also the Tony Allen health issue. So I think Memphis has the least chance. Houston probably has the least chance, I think, just because they're on the road. Then it would be Memphis, especially because I just don't see them winning Game 7 here by any means. And then, so what do you think on the Eastern Conference? It comes down to those two series. Is it Chicago? I think Chicago, I would give them the better chance of forcing a Game 7. We still don't know what Cleveland's health situation is. Kyrie could kind of have a regression. Gasol may be back. Maybe he'll help. It all depends on how he's used. If he's used with Noah, I don't like that. But Gasol could add some offense if he's not used with Noah. And maybe by some miracle he'll even start with Taj Gibson, which I think might be the Bulls' best defensive starting lineup. So a lot of that, as always, depends on the player usage and, you know, obviously how those guys play too. But I think the Bulls have the most potential to win the series, but maybe not the greatest odds of fulfilling it compared to Washington. I think Washington is more likely to give a steady effort. And it's pretty close to a toss-up to me between those two series.
Yeah, it's definitely close to me between those two series. I would lean towards the Wizards by the sole virtue that those games to me have been closer in the sense that, you know, they've been even games not only in result but just in play. And Washington also has the benefit of John Wall. I mean, they were missing him for one of those games, and I feel like he's a very important part. But between those two series, it's hard to parse. And then in terms of the Rockets versus the Grizzlies, I think it's kind of two different questions in that I think the Rockets have a much lower chance of forcing a Game 7, but I also think they have a much better chance of winning a Game 7.
Yeah,
so,
just because they're at home.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. Like, so that's why I think they're asking two different questions. And yeah, that you could think of that as hedging, but I really don't think so because it's the home road thing. But also, as you said, Memphis has won a game at Oracle in this series, but that feels like a long time ago right now. And while I think they have a very reasonable shot of winning Game 6, a Game 7 here, especially considering how the Warriors, it seems like they've done a better job of figuring out Memphis as the series has gone along, I feel like that it would be possible, but very difficult.
84, I think forcing a Game 7, Memphis is a greater shot. Actually winning the series, I might actually give Houston a greater shot. Now that you said that, that's a good point. And 78 and 84 points for Memphis in the last two games in what are high possession games against the Warriors. I mean, that's just not going to cut it. I just don't see how they're going to be able to score against this Warriors team. And so that always provides like a really high floor for the Warriors against this Memphis team now that they seem to have figured them out defensively.
Well, there's also the dynamic in that Houston is a much higher ceiling team. And I think you can make an argument for Houston in a lot of different circumstances for that. I think Chicago is a high ceiling team as well. And then you have that with the two of them. But, you know, I think that's enough on this topic.
Yeah, Rose's shoulder injury also potentially
troubles. Oh, that's true. Good point.
For Chicago. Let's see if he can get back because that was definitely bothering him in Game 5. All right, let's move on to it. We've got time for a couple more here. This is from Eric Black, Eric_Black3. Better, parentheses, illegal screener, KG or Bogut? I'm going to go KG. Probably not even really that close to me. KG, just one of the best at it, well-renowned for it. Especially when you consider KG's like not even really like the thickest guy around either. Compared to Bogut, who's like a little bit more, kind of a bruiser. So, yeah, I'd go with KG on this one.
often imitated, never duplicated, and you also have the nuance with KG that he's such a good pick and pop player that you have to move greater nuance in terms of just dealing with that as a defense that you have to defend. I mean, Bogut's a good screener, but you don't have to worry about much of an action that he's creating. I mean, obviously with the teammates he plays with, having, you know, doing those screens for Steph Curry is very different than doing them for Rajon Rondo. But I feel like KG is a better screener and a better illegal screener too.
Next one is from David Giovanazzi. Distracted David is his handle. What have you thought of Lee's defense compared to Spates's? Second unit's passing was fun. I think Lee actually, as the center, he's not as good one-on-one in the post. Spates has a little bit more heft. But also I think Lee is going to fight a little bit harder. He's not quite as spacey. He'll execute the system a little bit more defensively. And when everyone was on a string the way they were tonight, Lee can hold up, especially when you've got some of these backup units that he's going against, and you've got four guys around him who are all 6'7 or so with long arms and are switching everything. So, yeah, I think Lee actually may have been a little bit better than Spates has been of late, but, you know, not really. Neither of them are fantastic, but, you know, and it's not really clear either way, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, within a team concept, I think that Lee did a pretty good job in this game. And also, he fought hard on the defensive boards. Harder, you and I have given him blip at various moments in the past for his sometimes lax defensive rebounding. But in this game, I think he did a much better job of that, and that was very important because you have to close a possession, and that's a part of defense as well.
All right, let's move on to another one here. This is from the Hungarian Jordan. Blatt started Kyrie on Rose in Game 5 and sits Mozgov fourth quarters. Both seem like big errors to me. Thoughts? Well, I do think Kyrie starting on Rose in Game 5, he should basically never be on Rose. Hide him somewhere else, especially with him being so injured and having really only a limited amount of times that you think he can try and explode. You need him for offense. They have Shumpert. Shumpert is basically, you know, a guy to guard Rose. That's sort of what he's built for. So I think I agree, and they usually get away from that pretty quickly. But, I mean, why not just go to the real matchup right away? With Mozgov, Mozgov was horrendous in Game 5. The minutes that he was on the floor, Cleveland just could not score to save their lives. He was just flubbing everything inside. He was awesome in Game 4, and he played down the stretch in Game 4 and was great protecting the rim. But I think generally Thompson offers a little bit more versatility, a little better finishing inside, a little better offensive rebounding, the ability to switch out on guys defensively and to trap guys and make them throw it to Noah where, you know, offensive possessions go to die these days. So, I don't think that either of those is incredibly egregious and also not necessarily as extreme as the question might have indicated.
Yeah, I think that Kyrie starting on Rose is definitely something that could be corrected and I think should be corrected. But I actually like what David Blatt, the fighter pilot, has done in terms of the mentality in choosing between Mozgov and Thompson.
Well,
I think
that's he has to get up to his 200 decisions, right? So, like, that's why you have to start off with different matchups so you can then switch them so he can actually make more decisions. That's to fulfill his statement that he makes 150 to 200 decisions per game.
Yeah, and so I think that you go into it with the idea that, you know, whichever one of them is playing better. The margin between Thompson and Mozgov, especially considering they should not play both of them in crunch time, is tight enough that you can do it on that flexible of a thing as long as the players themselves are fine with it. And I haven't heard anything from either one of them to say it. And it's very clear that if the top dog in your team is willing to criticize the coach, then I think it's a little bit of open season to that point. So, yeah, I think that's fine. Another question that I thought was interesting, and it's hard to answer at this point, but it's from Henry Mills, and his handle is Original Goonch, G-O-O-N-C-H. And he asks, who is the coach of the playoffs so far? Is it crazy to say Whitman?
No, it's not in the slightest. He's gotten some great looks for them out of timeouts, going with this small lineup, shooting so many more threes until this last game. He certainly would be most improved coach. We could say that for sure. And, who else would be a potential candidate here?
Steve Kerr, to me. Because Kerr has made, since game two or three has made a lot of adjustments that made this important, not only in terms of the defensive assignments, but in terms of the rotation. I think that they've done, the way that they've used Sean Livingston has been
huge. But although I don't want to give him credit for something he should have been doing anyway. Barbosa, he should have been having Livingston in there this whole time instead of Barbosa. I don't understand his fascination with Barbosa through the whole year. Statistically, he's never been a good player. He takes away from, when I say statistically, just in terms of plus minus and you know, real plus minus, he's been bad. He also just defensively takes so much away from what they want to do from a switching standpoint, and Livingston is, you know, fits right in with all the other athletes they have, and Barbosa is a weak point. He takes away just from the physical force of the team, and not someone who I think really, you know, should have been, you know, you can argue him or Justin Holliday, but once you get into the playoffs, really, and you've got Livingston available to take those minutes, especially against this Memphis team when they're struggling defending. It was the right move, but I think it should have been that way all along, so I don't want to necessarily give him credit for that. I do agree, though, that the Bogut thing was a masterstroke on Tony Allen, and just generally their philosophy to help out more, though I still think that they could have been a little bit more help-oriented on those post guys, even to start with Memphis's lack of shooting. So, yeah, you know, I think when you look especially at a team that has overachieved over what its talent level is, what they've done in the regular season, I think you probably have to go with Whitman. My other candidate actually would be Doc Rivers.
Yeah, I think that he's done a good job in a hard situation. I think that GM Doc made Coach Doc's life a lot more difficult. They don't really have a true backup point guard. Austin Rivers is more of a two in my eyes. And
he's been getting stuff out of those guys.
Yeah,
though,
absolutely.
Who are pretty limited.
And Spencer Hawes reclamation project has already begun. And the challenge for them is going to be, I mean, Doc has done, I think he's done a good job so far, but assuming they make the conference finals, they're going to have a real tough road.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they won that game one on the road in that series, which is basically, you know, it would be 3-2 Houston right now if they hadn't done that, even if the Clippers totally outplayed them since Paul's come back. So winning that game one on the road against Houston was huge. I mean, I think I wouldn't say he at the very least, fought Popovich to a draw. He had some real nice after timeout plays. And not really, I can't think of that many just major mistakes that he's made. Maybe going with the all bench unit early on, but he's gone away from that too. So, yeah, I mean, I think his team and Whitman's team have both been the ones who have overachieved the most. And this will lead into our last question of the night. This is from one of our favorite Twitter handles. Listener Ryan Icarus Descends is his handle. What has been your favorite ATO play of the second round and favorite defensive adjustment?
You want me to start?
Please.
Okay, so my favorite ATO play so that I can think of is the one that ended that I called the Hammer of Thor, which was the last play of the last offensive play for Washington. I thought
that was
beautiful.
That was going to be my post or my choice too.
Yeah, it was a really well executed play, and what I liked about it was it got a guy open who I'm guessing Atlanta thought was going to be the guy because of all of the other movement that was going on. Best defensive adjustment.
Well, the other thing about that, too, I'll pick the same one, although obviously, you know, I can't say that I have every single one in my head, perfect photographic recall at this moment. But the other thing that was awesome about that one was you're on the road, going for the three really statistically, especially if you can get an open one when you're down two, gives you a much better chance of winning. I mean, if you think about it, you know, if you're going for a two, say you got a 50% chance of making that two. So you got a 50% chance of that, and then you have a 50% chance of winning in overtime. So you really, if you go for a two, you got a 25% chance of winning the game. If you go for a three, theoretically, although they had another possession to go back the other way, but if you go for a three, theoretically, let's say you have a 35% chance of hitting a three, then you win the game. So you got a 35% chance of winning if you go for a three. So if you can get an open three, especially from a guy like Pierce, and that shot that he got him was really, you know, probably a 42% shot, corner three, wide open from a guy who's been on fire from three. That gives you the best chance to win the game, especially on the road when you're playing a team that, you know, just outplayed them in the fourth quarter. So, yeah, it was that's got to be my favorite, I think.
And best defensive adjustment, I mean, maybe it's recency bias, but for the one for me was the Warriors just realizing they didn't have to guard Tony Allen. I mean, I think that it was something that I totally didn't see coming. I've been around this team the whole year and didn't think of it. And Adams deserves a lot of credit, Kerr, everybody. You know, everybody deserves it. And for using Bogut in a way that worked really well and also forcing, as much as we want to say it, forcing Memphis to take Tony Allen out. I mean, it looks like now that his injury had occurred before that, but that was huge. I mean, that it didn't, I don't want to say it swung the series because you don't know what would have happened otherwise, but it was definitely an important factor in it.
Yeah, and not only not guarding him, but having Andrew Bogut or later when he got into foul trouble, Draymond Green, be the one who was not guarding him. And I actually, it's probably something that I should have thought of because I advocated something similar back in 2013 when the Bulls were going against that Heat small lineup that would close. I was actually saying they should put Joakim Noah on Dwayne Wade since he was the guy who's not going to shoot threes. And instead they were having Noah guard Ray Allen, and that worked out terribly, as you might expect having your best help defender on their best shooter. But yeah, so I think that's something that can really work well is just, you know, if you have a guy who's a non-threat no matter what position, just guard him with one of the league's best help defenders. So, yeah, that's been a good one. I mean, can you think of any other candidates that come to mind at the moment?
I'm trying to think if there was anything in Spurs-Clippers that really stood out, because that was another series where there were a lot of adjustments, but I can't think of any off the top of my head. Well, I mean, I'm still impressed with the job that Redick and Crawford have done. I mean, just in various moments, but I don't think that's really an adjustment in that sense.
Yeah, you know, I think there's nothing really quite as macro as that Bogut thing, although, and Jaeger said, oh, well, you know, that wasn't what lost us, you know, he only guarded him for 7 possessions. Well, yeah, that's because you had to take him out.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe that was just due to the injury as well, that was part of it, but, yeah, you know, I'm actually a little frustrated. I can't think of anything else. Maybe we'll supplement this on tomorrow's show if we can think of something.
Yeah, I like the question.
That's a great question, though. Yeah, great question. Yeah, Ryan's always got good ones. All right, let's call it quits for tonight. As the cleanup crew also seems to be finishing up their work. So we'll get out of here. Thanks again for listening. I'm Nate Duncan, NBA on Twitter. Danny is Danny LaRue. You can subscribe either on the Real GM site or, of course, on iTunes. And we will talk to you all tomorrow night.